We shouldn't rule it out in a commercial service. If we're going to have vehicle service in commercial service, then we should allow or at least give the ability to petition to allow like a sales lot of any kind in commercial service.
And so the intent of the sales lot is a little nuanced. The definition explicitly doesn't include vehicle sales or farm equipment supplies. Those are both under different categories. This is more of a space that can be used for like a swap meet. So I think it may already be addressed under vehicle sales and farm equipment and sales.
I think of a swap meet as a non-permanent establishment. This is says permanent establishment for outdoor sales of items used or new.
Yeah, not including vehicles or farm equipment.
777.
Yeah.
Glenn's repair. Like stuff like that. I mean, you could sell trailers, anything. I'm not going to die on this hill. I'm just thinking that it's hog tying potential business.
I think the thing is on that, I guess in a lot of people's mind, it would depend on what's being sold, perhaps. But it's a good point about you look at like Glenn's Repair. Is that a sales lot or is it just a retail business? I mean, it seems like it's just a retail business because they rent things, they sell things. I'm not sure if staff has any further comment on that item. You know, or whether what would be the harm of having it as a CUP in the CS zone?
I don't think there's a harm from doing that. If it's a CUP, then we can have discretion on
Okay.
things that could happen there.
Are you okay with adding CUP to that, to the CS category for sales lots? Okay. Yeah. Got it. Okay, I did have just a generic question. It's something Councilmember Funk brought up earlier about like businesses that want to have on-site daycare, and you talked about that being an ancillary use. If I'm a business though, and you know, I look at my business as an allowed use in where I'm proposing to do it under this zoning, under this table, but I do want to have some ancillary uses, whether it be a, you know, a battery storage or it's daycare or it's this or that. How do I know what is, you know, potentially going to be allowed in the terms of an ancillary use, or do I just have to come and ask? And do we have a policy in general, like, you know, on-site daycare for businesses? Because that's something in general we want to encourage, but do we have that codified anywhere?
We do. We have a discussion on accessory uses. Not sure where that's going with our new code, but it certainly is something we have thresholds on in terms of the floor area. Oftentimes, we've used in the past less than 50% of the floor area, sometimes less. I forget where our current code is going with that or whether
That's
we
okay.
have
I don't need
that.
to get into specifics. I just want to
Certainly.
make sure that
Yes.
there's you know, a point of reference a business could go to and get those questions answered. So we don't need to get into it tonight. So, okay, thank you. So you have our suggested changes. I think we had concurrence and consensus up here on those. So I think we're good to go, right? This is sufficient for you. Okay, you have one.
I'm sorry, I just noticed this last one, and I apologize again if somebody mentioned this and I missed you guys talking about it. The recreational vehicle park, not allowed in industrial. I know we had one that was applied for about a year ago or so, started to go and then it failed. But why not have? I know like that place on Traffic Way was used for that, and it's probably not the
Now
best
that's
place for it.
storage, not a park.
Well, I mean, well, how it. Oh, a park. I'm thinking of parking your vehicle. Okay, so, all right, I'm just reading this wrong then. So a park as in what's was going to go over by Del Rio. Okay,
Terms of
never mind.
lodging. Yeah, that's a lodging facility or a hotel,
Okay.
motel
All
type.
right. I'm just looking at it as parking your recreational vehicle. Thank you.
Right. I did the first time I looked at it, I did as well. Okay, I think we're good then on this, and we will proceed to the C and the CI zone discussion. And Councilmember Peak, you.
I'm recusing myself of my interests in both those zones.
Okay, thank you. You obviously can listen downstairs. I believe you can speak as a member of the public if you desire on this item. And the only thing after this is council committees and reports. So we will see you for that. Okay, thank
2 minutes
you.
stretch break,
Yeah, let's take
or
a
do we
stretch
get
break
you know
while Councilmember Peak recuses
get some
himself, and
water?
let's make
Thanks.
it fairly quick. It's 8:04. Let's take a 6-minute break and be back in our seats at 8:10.
AM 1230, KPRL and 99.3 FM, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton.
Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
As president, he led the United States through two of the greatest crises in recent history, the Great Depression and World War II. As a man, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's confidence and vitality made him one of the most beloved figures of the 20th century. Though physically crippled by polio, Roosevelt rallied America through some of its darkest hours, assuring citizens struggling through the Great Depression that they had nothing to fear but fear itself. The nation responded by making him the only man elected president 4 times, the fourth in 1944, despite his increasingly evident deteriorating health. But with the nation still at war with Germany and Japan, the American people stuck with their courageous commander-in-chief. By April 1945, Franklin Roosevelt had been president for more than 12 years, guiding the nation from the brink of economic ruin to the verge of victory in World War II. But on April 12th, while vacationing in Warm Springs, Georgia, he suffered a massive cerebral hemorrhage.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Fulton Lewis, Jr., speaking from the Mutual Studios in New York City. This nation has suffered this day a staggering loss. At this moment at Warm Springs, Georgia, President Franklin D. Roosevelt lies with the problems of the nation finally lifted from his shoulders, stricken late this afternoon with cerebral hemorrhage. He passed away before his physicians could be of any assistance, if assistance in such a case is possible at all. Vice President Harry Truman, who from here on will be President Truman, went immediately to the White House. A special cabinet meeting was called, and we should know more about what is going to happen in Washington as the evening wears on. But Franklin D. Roosevelt, the first president to be elected for 4 terms in the White House, has passed away, and that is the overshadowing of all news events that have happened or can happen for quite a while.
The news of Franklin Roosevelt's death plunged the country into shock and mourning. Thousands stood silent along the railroad tracks as the train bearing his coffin made its slow trip from Georgia northward to his final resting place in Hyde Park, New York, bidding goodbye to a president whose indomitable spirit had inspired a nation through poverty and war, and whose legacy would benefit and inspire future generations of Americans for decades to come.
Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air. True stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell.
The mission was daring and complicated. The flights of B-24s would take off from airfields in Libya, fly more than 1,200 miles, and approach their target area at treetop levels. The mission was also considered vital to the Allied war effort. Its purpose? Destroy German oil refineries that were the lifeblood of the Nazi war machine. 5 U.S. airmen would receive the nation's highest award for valor when it was over. Ploiești, Romania, August 1st, 1943. One of those 5 was Colonel John R. Kane of the Army Air Corps, who led the 3rd Element of heavy bombers in the mass low-level attack. En route to the target, Colonel Kane's element became separated from the leading portion of the formation while avoiding dense and dangerous cumulus cloud conditions over mountainous terrain. But rather than turn back from such a vital mission, Colonel Kane elected to press on to the target. When he reached it, he discovered that another group had apparently missed its target and instead attacked and damaged the target assigned to his element. Despite the now thoroughly worn defensives, intensive anti-aircraft fire, enemy fighter planes, oil fires and explosions and dense smoke over the target, and the real danger of explosions from delayed action bombs previously dropped, Colonel Kane led his formation into the attack. By his brilliant courage, gallant leadership, and superior flying skill, he and the formation under his command successfully attacked the vast refinery that was so vital to the enemy war effort. Through his conspicuous gallantry in this most hazardous mission, and by his intrepidity at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty, Colonel Kane made a vital personal contribution to the mission's success. Army Air Corps Colonel John S. Kane was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor in recognition of his gallantry, courage, and heroic acts.
The Air Force Association is proud to bring you Heroes of the Air, dedicated to those who earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Their service and sacrifice reflect an ideal that puts others and country above self. AFA salutes all men and women in the Air Force who so selflessly serve our country each day at home and around the globe. Heroes of the Air is produced by Pelcom Communications in association with Radio America.
Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to council. And again, some of the changes we suggested may also apply to C and CI zones, but let's just start and see what comments you have, either any clarifying that you want to add those as well. You don't need to go over each one, but if you think the changes we discussed in the last thing also apply to C and CI, or if you want to add anything else. So I'll start with Councilmember Funk.
Yep, there we go. I would add on the contract construction services, we made that change in the out in the industrial area only, and I would not be keen on changing it in the in any other zone.
Understand.
Okay. And the horticultural specialties, I asked for that to be changed in the industrial zone, but I don't think we necessarily need to change it in the other zones. A couple of the other zones are already A/AUP. So I think it's okay with that one change.
It does under C say A/CUP. You don't want to make that A/AUP.
Well, in the commercial district, I'd be okay to make it AUP. I think what we're talking about with those businesses is somebody making sure that you site the compost bins appropriately so that it doesn't look ugly and interfere with other businesses. And, you know, ugly is always in the mind of the eye of the beholder. if you love plants, that compost smells great, right?
Say, or in the ears or nose of the beholder.
Yes, that too, yeah. So, but yeah, but I'd be okay with changing a commercial to an AUP. A/AUP instead of A/CUP.
Right.
Good. Thanks, Mayor. That's a good catch. laundromats, AUP across the board for those areas where it's currently a CUP. And we left it as a allowed use industrially. Or at least that was my intent. and I think the others we've covered, we want to be the change in studio and creative workshop was only allowed use in the industrial because it was already an allowed use in the other, so there's no change that's needed there. I think that does me.
Okay, thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Darras. Anything you'd like to add? Okay, and in which case, then, how do you feel about the suggestions made by Councilmember Fong?
I'm good with them. I think they're fine.
Okay. I as well can live with those changes you suggested, and I don't have any other suggested additional changes. So
I wanted on the allowed use for the tattoo and body piercings in the
right.
Yeah.
We'll
make a may across the board.
Make a may across the board, correct.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. Okay. Does staff have anything they want to comment on or any concern about those suggested changes?
Could I just ask for clarification on the caretaker units?
Yes.
Was that just a change to industrial zone, or were you looking?
No, that was across the board.
Right, and that was to make that AUP.
AUP. Change it from CUP to AUP.
Yeah.
I mean, staff can handle whatever technical thing needs to be handled, and if somebody needs to live on site,
right,
we should make that possible.
Right. So it would apply to these two zones we're discussing now.
Yeah.
To make it an AUP. Okay. I think we are good. Staff, you're good with that guidance?
Very good.
Okay. All right. Thank you. With that, we can invite Councilmember Peak back up because we are ready to move on to our next item, which is our council announcements and committee report. So I will begin on my right with Councilmember Funk.
I think we have one more before we call him back. I think, what do we have?
Yes, we have the Commercial Innovation District.
Discussing both C and CI right now, and that our comments pertain to both C and CI.
Yes, thank you. Development standards are next.
Oh, development standards.
Oh, okay.
Wait, I'm sorry. Development.
That's the chart on page 20.
It's going to be really quick. Don't worry.
Okay. Which page?
Page 20 of your packet.
Okay, right, because that pertains specifically to CI, correct?
Yeah, there's a chart that had development standards on.
Yeah.
We have a little more presentation to pop up.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
So, yes, page 20. Oh, go ahead.
Great. Thank you. So the purpose of this district, we've talked about it already, really fostering that space for production and design maker spaces to thrive. Go ahead to the next slide. We've got some images of what that might look like. The vision for this zone is really to have that maker production identity and foster those kinds of uses, visually adaptable frontages. So just kind of looking at the map of where the CI zone lives in town, there's two parts. This is the northern part. And the existing land uses are shown here. So this is actually what is on the ground today. And so when you turn this map on, you see it's really kind of a mix of industrial, commercial, a little bit of vacant and residential thrown in there as well.
We'll take a visual.
We can see it on page 23, but the public won't be able to see
it. Yeah, the public can't.
Screen. So. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure the map on page 23 is what she's referring to, is it?
She's referring.
Oh, okay.
On the map on page 23. But go ahead and please keep talking to it.
Sorry,
staff
thank you.
Can try to get it up on the screen.
Sure thing. So we're taking just kind of a Google Street View drive down the corridor to kind of put us kind of where we're familiar with the area and the uses along the area, really quite mixed throughout, but some of that light industrial and then kind of mixing of the uses as well. Here's the south side of the CI zoning district. This is the area that is included. And then when we turn on the map for the existing land uses, we see that this is, again, a mix of uses, more commercial and some industrial mixed in here as well. And taking a quick drive down the corridor, we see the uses starting at the north, or this is kind of the northern end of the southern part with a mix of uses and a mix of development types too, as well as we drive along the corridor and ending near the southern end with vacant and uses that seem to kind of align with the commercial innovation division. So thinking about the development standards that will facilitate that vision, we've drafted some standards that are really intentionally kind of basic. We don't want to make it too complicated. We really just want to focus on those key items that can support adaptability of structures moving forward and making sure that we're being flexible. So to that end, the setbacks are really flexible. The requirements are really just linked to those where street trees are required. And if the parcel is adjacent to a residential zoning district, they'll have some extra setbacks. And then we think about where is outdoor storage occurring? We don't want it to be happening right along El Camino. We'd like it to happen behind the buildings. So really not allowing fences right up front against the property, but instead pushing them back with the outdoor storage behind the buildings, and really encouraging any new development to push buildings closer to the street. And then ground floor ceiling heights are an important one here to allow for that adaptability. You know, we do kind of want a forklift to get in and out, some roll-up doors there, and allow that hybrid industrial and commercial use to occur. So one of those key features is a requirement for roll-up doors. You don't have to install a roll-up door, but the building should be designed to facilitate this type of development at a later point in time. So we really want to be able to make sure that those types of uses can allow access into the interior spaces. And then there's one kind of modest requirement for transparency. When you're looking from the primary street, largely this is El Camino and on most of these parcels, to have some transparency. So this is glass windows or doors, and making up 20% of the street facade. So these kind of standards are really intended to help the vision that's already manifesting with Barrow Creek really come to fruition. So we see that here's another example of not a local industrial building, but how it might transition over time into a hybrid, more retail makerspace development with a lot of different types of uses. So really setting in place the standards that are pretty basic, but would allow this type of vision really to get implemented. And I think I did that in less than 5 minutes. So ready for questions and discussion.
Okay, thank you. I have a question regarding, well, one, I want to clarify for the public. When we say minimum lot size 2 acres, that's for any property that's larger than 2 acres. We wouldn't allow that to be subdivided below 2 acres because most of these lots, existing lots, are already smaller than 2 acres, correct?
That's right. And it doesn't, that wouldn't prohibit them from being developed that like that. And it wouldn't prohibit someone even subdividing down smaller if they came in with a development plan for what they wanted to do.
Got it. Because when I first saw that, I thought, wait, most of these lots that we're talking about are already much smaller than 2 acres, and that explains the rationale. The floor-to-ceiling ground floor height, 16 feet. Now, we discussed that issue somewhat at length previously in some other areas. We're in a previous discussion, and we had 16 feet, 15 feet, 14 feet, 12 feet, and we narrowed it down to a couple. But I thought we narrowed it down more to 14 feet. What did we do? Because 16 seems like a lot. I assume that question that would also only be applicable to multi-story buildings. Or are we saying if somebody builds a one-story building, it's going to that you want it to be 16 feet?
We had that discussion with our mixed-use districts, and we did decide on a couple different ceiling heights on varying different mixed-use districts. Now we're having the same discussion in these other commercial zones for these ground floor spaces, based on what we're seeing and it takes to support the kinds of land uses we want to see there.
Right. But if somebody comes in and you know, they want to build something and for their particular use, they see no need for 16 foot ceiling. In fact, maybe they don't even see a need for a 12 foot ceiling, but I'm a little hesitant to go to 16 feet. Cause if you talk about the building height being a maximum of 35, then essentially, 35 feet, they're not going to get 3 stories out of that because they'd only have 19 feet left for on top of the 16 foot minimum, and they're not going to get 2 stories in 19 feet. So are we really saying
you can still fit 3 stories in all these commercial zones even with a 16 foot ground floor ceiling height?
What, one would be 10 and one would only be 9 feet in, with all of the, you know,
the way that the way that the top floor is measured, it's measured, Kelly, you might have to help me out, but it's measured from like more like 7 feet. So it's allowed to have that variation to make that flexibility happen. And so I think the intent behind the 16 feet is also to support the roll-up doors as well. Some of them require additional space for that roll-up space. Some of them even up to 30 inches. And to have that space to have, you know, a forklift actually come through the space. It does have to have a little bit more height than some of our, than all of our mixed use zones actually. So this this zone actually does kind of support that higher ceiling height vision.
Interesting. But we did in our prior discussion, as you said, I think we ended up with 14 for some things. I don't know, recall us ending up with 16 for some things, but
I believe we ended up at 16 for our highest use mixed use zone, the vertical mixed use zone, but we would have to
go back and check. So you think we ended up at like 14 and 16 or something like that? Okay.
Correct.
It just, I don't know. It feels, I'm a little concerned about that being a cost for folks. What would be the latitude for somebody to come in and say, I just, you know, I don't have any intent to use it in that way or that form. We're trying to preserve them for future uses, but it's always difficult to tell a property owner, you know, the property owner now who wants to build something that, oh, but we want to make sure you build it to allow some other things in the future.
Yeah, there's always a design, though there will always be a design exception process to ask. You know, what we have found is when somebody builds an office building for offices, it precludes future use. And right. there's not many people that come in and tear down a building. So the property will forever not be allowed to be the flexible zone that we envision if we don't create the spaces that allow for that over time.
Okay, understand. All right, thank you. Councilmember Darris, questions? And let's try to keep questions.
I'll keep it quick, but to comment on the 16-foot ceiling, it's funny. I almost think in some way, even a taller ceiling, would be almost better in some cases because it provides you the opportunity for a mezzanine space. 16, you can't, if you have a 16-foot tall ceiling, you're not going to turn that into a second floor, you know, for an office or something that you're going to do upstairs. Maybe some sort of weird storage with a low ceiling. But again, going up to 20 feet would probably do it. But then you are limiting the overall height of the building or what you can do with it. But anyway, but as far as the 16 feet, I'm good with that. And I just wanted to comment on that. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Questions, Councilmember Pump?
Yes. On the minimums front setbacks versus fencing. If somebody wanted a low fence that's related to how they want to decorate the front of the property, is that fencing requirement consistent with what we've done in the setbacks? I'm not sure that it is.
We can definitely add an allowance for like a low decorative fencing. I know there's some that have like a split rail just decoratively, and this is not intended to be that.
Yeah, I'm not looking at 6 foot or 8 foot visual screening fences flat up against the sidewalk. That's not going to give the right vibe on the zone. But shorter decorative fences, yes. Okay, so that could be distinguished. And looking at what we've got in what will become this zone now, do you have a sense of what percentage of the buildings currently meet that 20% transparent openings requirement?
I don't have a great sense. I think there are a lot of buildings, even when we look at the Joe Bella Center, when we look at Mitch's new development up there, I think a decent amount do generally have some windows and glazing facing El Camino Real.
Sure. I'm sure that a lot of places have some. I'm just trying to square the requirement for big roll-up door front and having 20% of it be glass. So you've got a roll-up door, but you also have a fair amount of frontage beside it, where you've got to have windows and so forth.
The roll-up doors don't necessarily have to face El Camino, so it's based on site design. So your roll-up doors would be facing your loading areas, an interior parking lot, somewhere where you're going to have that ability to, again, get the forklifts through and things like that. It's not necessarily facing El Camino. So El Camino just has sort of a requirement to have some sort of storefront or entranceway that is glazed so that it's not a blank wall.
Yeah. Okay. So if you think about the area where Glass Hat Studios has their shop, you've got, that's a fairly deep section of land, and it's got multiple banks of, if you will, of buildings. It's got, you know, three rows of buildings building back. Only this would this a requirement for the public street frontage transparently openings apply only to those portions of that area facing El Camino Real and not to any of the other buildings back behind?
Yeah, and I think she's not on El Camino in a little bit different zone, but yes, if that were to be built there, it's only the buildings along the public street.
Okay.
Base along the public street.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good question. Yeah, because those folks don't have a street frontage in effect. So, okay, let's go out and see if we have any public comment on this item.
Good evening. I'll try to make this quick. Can we put up the very last slide that was showed, if that's possible, please? While I'm waiting for that, I'll comment on the roll-up doors. Glenn's repair has 10 foot. I can tell you I wish I had 12, and 12 should be the minimum opening. So therefore, it should be 14 feet with a header, because getting things in and out, definitely. I don't know if you should put a requirement on max, but minimum for sure. I think it's a great idea. If you look where those umbrellas are on this slide, there's a fence there. And that said, no fencing at all. I think that should be written in that you can go 3 feet or 4 feet. Maybe it's see-through or something. Maybe you need to close your patios down in the evening for security reasons or ABC or something. So having a no fence, I think, is a mistake, unless you want to put a definition in. And then lastly, if you put a roll-up door in, and this is a glazed question, could you also put in beautiful glass doors behind it, and would that count as glazing? Thank you.
Okay. I think the first question you raised, Councilmember Funk asked that question, and they answered that the fence discussion in this item as presented was talking about solid fences and stuff. Decorative fences were not intended to be excluded, and maybe just need to clarify that.
We'll clarify that
in the definition. Yeah, I'm not sure I understood the second question there. I don't know if staff has a comment on that. If you understood that and have a comment,
I'm not sure I understood it all the way.
Okay, I suggest you talk with staff afterwards. Go ahead, and Councilmember Funk.
I think the question is, if looking at the image here on the right, you see some
roll up.
You see windows that are sort of rolled up or whatever. If the landowner decided to have windows and a roll-up door, a different structure so that the roll-up door would sort of cover the windows, but you had glass behind it, then, and so sometimes it could be covered with the roll-up and sometimes it would be open, would that qualify? So it's essentially like the roll-up door becomes a shutter. I'm hoping that I characterize that. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we've considered a security shutter situation.
Essentially, that's what we're referring to, though, right? Is that you'd have a security shutter, so at night it wouldn't be transparent, but during business day you'd roll it up and got a transparent door. Good question. Hadn't thought about that in that way. I think,
and that would be still considered a storefront. That's an opening. The idea is to have this welcoming, open appearance. It's part of the architecture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it. But driving by in the middle of the night, it might not look so inviting.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Understood. Any other comments then from council members? Okay.
I think this is okay. I do think it's important to clarify the fencing and make sure we have the open fencing. I know I can work with the 16-foot requirement in this zone, given the guidance of staff about the importance of roll-ups and forklifts, et cetera.
I probably still have a little bit of concern, but I given my colleagues' comments and staff's explanation, I can live with the 16-foot in this instance. So, okay, any other comments? Staff, are we good in terms of the guidance provided? Okay, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Thank you, Genevieve. I believe we're ready to move on now to are council announcements and committee reports. And Councilmember Peak, if you're welcome to return, and we will hold you off till last, and we'll start on my right then with Councilmember Funk.
Okay, I'll report that last week, Mayor Pro Tem Daris and I were in Sacramento at the League of California Cities City Leaders Summit. This is an annual educational and lobbying opportunity, and was there advocating for our city with Senator Laird, Assemblymember Addis, and other members with regard to our wastewater treatment and homeless funding and other concerns for our city. And like many of us, the mayor was schlepping and serving soup at the Echo Empty Bowls fundraiser, which brought in over almost $100,000 for homeless services in our community and the shelter expansion there. So I meant, like many of us, I was happy to attend and support.
Thank you. Yes, I got to serve soup alongside our fire chief, Casey Bryson. Okay, I actually had a city selection committee meeting this morning, and which lasted very briefly, even shorter than our 17-minute meeting last time, where we reappointed two members of the Airport Land Use Commission. And we are going to be hosting the County Mayor's Roundtable or the Mayor's Meeting in May. We're going to do it right here in this chamber because it's always a beautiful thing. We're blessed to have the most impressive city hall for hundreds of miles around. So, and I did attend a special meeting of the of Central Coast Community Energy because of the battery rebate program was oversubscribed. And so the decision had to be made as to, shut it off at the budgeted, well, it was already over budget, shut it off at the amount already paid or honor applications that had also subsequently been received. And the decision was made to honor all the applications received to the tune of an additional $3.7 million or 513 customers who are installing battery systems. And that's all I've got. IWMA did not meet in April. So, Mayor Pro Tem Daris.
Okay, well, I won't repeat what Councilmember Funk said. We were in Sacramento. It was a great few days meeting with a lot of different people, and the sessions that we went to, I think, was very informative. APCD is meeting, in a couple of weeks. So I got that, and I'm looking forward to judging tamales this Saturday. So please join us for tamales and fun this Saturday.
Councilmember Pete.
No committee reports, but I'm also looking forward to eating tamales all morning, and that'll be a great time. Karen and I, my wife and I, had the pleasure attending Habitat for Humanity's dinner in Etna Valley. It's a big fundraiser and very successful, and our very own Lorelei Kappel had a hand in helping that evening, and it was just a great event. I recommend it next year to anybody who wants to attend.
Okay, thank you. Does any council member have any individual determinations or actions they'd like to bring up? Okay.
At this time, AM 1230 KPRL concludes this portion of the Atascadero City Council meeting, brought to you by Idler's Home. More of what you want for your home. Go to idlershome.com. We invite you to join us the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for the Atascadero City Council meeting. We now join our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton.
Did you hear that? I don't know. We all looked at each other and questioned it for at least a few seconds before, people started scurrying and stuff like that. But it was also interesting to see people's different reactions, right? Some just instinctually, dove for the floor. Others kind of slowly lowered themselves down, looking around.
And Paul, Paul, that one older gentleman who just sat there and continued to eat his dinner. Have you seen the video of that? I don't know who it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were some of the servers, the workers there that were still standing, not sure what to do. I'll admit myself, I was just fully upright, seated in my in my seat at the table, because again, I didn't really know what to do. What it's hard to explain. You look back and like, Paul, why didn't you get down? It's just hard to explain. In the moment, you're so confused. You know, you people just don't know what to do. And I guess I was one of them. But I got to tell you, though, I'm not sure how you feel about this. But for me, I feel a huge gratitude to law enforcement for stopping this guy, because he could have gotten further. He could have gotten down to the ballroom level. He didn't. He was one level up, right? They tackled him right away. They could have, you know, shot at him and maybe shot other people that were around, because there were other people up at that level, because that's where the men's room and ladies' rooms are. And in fact, I had gone to the men's room about 15 minutes or so before the shooting, because rumors started to spread. Hey, the president's going to start speaking soon, and when he does, they close the doors and you can't go in or out. So much of us were like, oh my God, we better go to the men's room right now.
That's a practical maneuver. Yeah, to get out and take care of that before the president's. Well, the only reason I've been critical is, number one, this guy just comes sprinting past the Secret Service, past a number of agents, and one of them, to his credit, spins around very quickly, pulls, draws, and aims. I thought that's exactly what you expect the Secret Service to do. But then pulling J.D. Vance off the head table, and the president's still sitting out there for 10 seconds afterwards, it just seemed very strange.
Well, and that's a good thing. I guess hopefully there'll be some sort of, you know, deep after action as to how things exactly happened, because there were other inconsistencies like that too. For example, FBI Director Kash Patel, I was seated near him. He was in the back kind of with us. He was at his table for like 10 minutes. I mean, they did not rush him out at all. The FBI director. Oh. So even though he was the one standing next to the president at the press conference, you know, later that evening, he was not rushed out of there. I mean, they got him out, but, you know, it wasn't like at all a rush.
Well, Paul, one thing, have you seen the manifesto this killer or potential killer wrote?
Actually, I've not read it myself, just heard clips.
It's
in the media.
It's fairly short. It's 1,000 words, you know, which a political consultant could knock out in 5 minutes. But it specifically excludes Patel. And I don't know why, except the only guess I've got is Patel is one of the few persons of color within the administration in those high ranks. And the shooter appears to be from a multiracial family. But that's the only theory I'd have. But he specifically says, my targets are all the upper echelons except Patel. And I thought, what's going on there?
Very interesting.
But Paul, I appreciate your insights. That's Paul Teller, president of Teller Strategies back in Washington, D.C. And by the way, if you're fed up with the current healthcare system, you know, the insurance companies, the pharmacy chains, the whole bureaucratic mess, you understand exactly why this pharmacy matters. All Family Pharmacy is not your typical pharmacy. They're an independent pharmacy on a mission to fix what's broken and put control right back where it belongs, between you and your doctor. Because All Family carries the medications that Big Pharma tried to keep away from all of us. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, mebezidol, methylene blue, and over 400 everyday prescriptions as well. The system works fine until it doesn't. All it takes is a delay or a shortage, an unexpected situation. Suddenly getting something simple turns into a major problem. The difference is preparation. The people already have what they need at home don't feel that pressure, like me, like my family. That's why All Family Pharmacy lets you plan ahead. Go online, fill out a short medical form. A licensed doctor reviews it. If appropriate, writes a prescription. Your medication ships right to your front door. That's what medical freedom looks like. No corporation in the middle. Go to allfamilypharmacy.com/Lars and use the code Lars10 for 10% off. That's allfamilypharmacy.com/Lars. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Also, there's a beehive outside your store, and they're super aggressive! There's thousands of them! Progressive knows small business owners usually don't like surprises because they cost you money. But a good surprise? Saving 13% on commercial auto insurance when you pay in full.
Also, the egg salad you just ate was expired! Gross!
Surprise yourself. See if you can save in as little as 8 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Help! Mother's Day's almost here and I have nothing for Mom.
Relax, sis. Just shop JTV. I already got Mom a gorgeous gold bracelet.
JTV, like jewelry television? Isn't that amazing?
Yes. They have thousands of gift and jewelry ideas, and their prices are unreal.
Okay, but how unreal are we talking?
Right now, new customers get $20 off your purchase of $99 or more at JTV.com. Use code DEAL20 now.
Why didn't you tell me this sooner?
Because I'm the mean sister.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/free. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free. ZipRecruiter.com/free.
ZipRecruiter.
With all the changes in the auto industry these days, keeping it up can be a challenge. So join me, Jimmy Purdy, on Gearhead Radio every Saturday at 9 a.m. I'm your go-to guy for all things automotive. Tune in as I share the latest advice and industry insights. Need help with your car? Call in and let's solve those car mysteries together. Here's the fun part. I'll share some of the hilarious mistakes I've made along the way, because let's face it, we've all got stories to tell. Gearhead Radio with me, Jimmy Purdy. It's not just a show, it's a community. Tune in this and every Saturday at 9 a.m.
AM 1230 KPRL North County Communications has openings from time to time for on-air, board operators, sales, and administrative positions. We encourage women and minorities to apply. Send your resume to KPRL, P.O. Box 7, Paso Robles, California, 93447, or you may drop off your resume at our studio, 32nd and Oak Street in Paso Robles. All resumes will remain on file. KPRL North County Communications is an equal opportunity employer.
Do you know someone that's working on redoing their yard? Steve Schmidt Topsoil has gift certificates for the do-it-yourselfer in your life. They deliver DG, road base, planter mix for the garden, and products for erosion control for cooler, wetter weather. Give the gift of a beautifully landscaped home. Call Steve Schmidt Topsoil, 805-237-0174, or stop by the Little Red Caboose off the 101.
The Estrella Warbirds Museum and Woodland Auto Display is open with new cars to see and so much wonderful history and fun. Aviation artifacts and memorabilia, and the flight simulator is so realistic and entertaining for all. The Estrella Warbirds and Woodland Auto Display on Dry Creek Road in Paso Robles, off of Airport Road. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 4.
Hi, it's Mimi at A-Town Diner. I'm here to tell you we're bringing back the old. That's what we've done here at A-Town Diner in Atascadero. We brought back the Early Bird Special for you early risers. Our delicious dinner menu starts at 4 o'clock daily, and we have a homemade soup of the day. We have also added some new. You can now order your to-go orders online at atowndiner.com. We offer discounts to active and retired military. Have a nonprofit or youth group fundraiser? Come see us. We are here for the community at A-Town Diner in Atascadero.
Parkfield, Shandon, Creston, and Heritage Ranch, a part of the Talk of North County, KPRL.
Follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, your hospital bill, if you've had any contact with the American healthcare system, you understand that bill is not just expensive. There is a government-designed system to make sure that it stays that way. So who's really getting rich off your medical debt? I thought we'd talk about that with John Graham, who's a visiting fellow who has contributed about 30 years of health policy expertise to research across all of Paragon's initiatives. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me this, what is this system that's designed to make sure that the hospital bills stay expensive, and who's getting the guilt off all that?
Well, the hospitals are, and the hospitals have kind of taken it easy, or they've gotten it easy from the politicians until recently. You know, drug companies, health insurance companies, the pharmaceutical middlemen, they all take heat from politicians, but the hospitals have this kind of ace up their sleeve, right? We're the largest employer in your district or your county or your city or your state. We got the emergency department. If you're in rural America, where are you going to get health care? So they've been able to scare politicians to give them massive subsidies and regulations that protect them. They restrict the ability of lower cost facilities to compete. And as Americans see every day, hospital prices and costs are just going up and up and up and up. And until recently, there's been no relief in sight. We've just released a paper going through all of the programs that they're overlapping, redundant, easy to manipulate by hospitals, hard for taxpayers and citizens to understand. And what they've resulted in is hospital prices increasing three times faster than general inflation in the 21st century. So think of Bidenflation a few years ago. Hospital prices were even higher than Bidenflation.
What I've never understood, though, John, is that, and I don't actually know the national number, a whole bunch of the hospitals in my neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest are so-called nonprofits. And yet the nonprofits seem to make multi-billion dollar profits, except I'm not sure exactly where the money is going when you're running a nonprofit and you pile up, I guess you'd call it excess revenue, revenue beyond expenses. You know, why do they want to do that when I understand why for-profit companies like Apple or Microsoft or whoever wants to pile up excess revenue because that's called profit. But when you're a nonprofit, why do they still seem to pile up giant piles of profit?
Well, and where does the money go? Of the top 10 CEOs of nonprofit organizations in the United States, nine are hospital CEOs. And up here in the Northwest, now I'm in Washington State, you're in Oregon.
Yep.
The you know, you got a lot of these big Catholic health systems, like Providence. If you get down towards California, you got Common Spirit Health. You know, these are multi-state Catholic hospital systems that pay their CEOs high 20s, $30 million a year. And if you go back 150 years, how did they start? You're talking about maybe a dozen religious sisters coming from Ireland or Bavaria or something who have taken a vow of poverty, right? Or, you know, and they earn no money, and they took care of cholera patients and typhoid patients. And now, 150 years later, we've got multi-million dollar earning CEOs who are running consolidated systems. So one of the things that's happened, and it gets worse every year, is they buy each other up and become consolidated and monopolistic. And again, government policies, the way Medicare pays them, the way Medicaid pays them, encourages this.
Well, and what is the incentive? I mean, other than for the CEO or maybe the top echelons of these hospital systems, what other incentive is there to pile up all this money as opposed to saying, hey, we appear to be running a surplus this year. Why don't we knock all of our charges down? Except the system really doesn't go in that direction, does it?
The system doesn't go in that direction at all. And we know that hospital executives are rewarded for size. For growing their size, not for becoming more efficient, not for becoming more productive, not for reducing costs, just for growing. And that's the way the government payment systems work.
So in other words, if you're a CEO and you have 1,000 people that work for you, you get one size paycheck. If you can grow that to 5,000 people working for you, you can go to your board of directors and say, I got 5,000 people working for me. I'm generating this much in revenue. You have to pay me accordingly. Why don't the boards of directors say, no, we don't have to spend $20 million to get the kind of expertise you offer to run a system?
Well, I think boards of directors of hospitals aren't held accountable the way a board of directors would be for a for-profit corporation. So they're sort of members of the community. I don't think they really have the incentive to have the kind of oversight that you would in a for-profit corporation. So the executives basically get to run the show on their own.
So how do we fix it?
Well, again, government is really the part of the problem. I mean, the hospital executives are behaving like, responding like normal human beings, right? So, to a system that rewards them for being big and inefficient and bloated. And there are a number of things that we proposed. One is a Medicare payment reform. The same procedure done at a doctor's office gets a lower Medicare payment in many cases than if it's done at a hospital. So guess what? Hospitals own physicians' offices. Hospitals have outpatient facilities where they get paid more only because they're more expensive, not because they give better quality care. Medicaid in most states has the same payment policy. So we got to keep progress on that, reforming those payment policies. The One Big Beautiful Bill fixed some of it, but we got more to do. There's another drug pricing program called 340B. That's too complicated a term, and I don't want to bog your listeners down. But it's a system whereby hospitals can buy drugs at lower cost than anybody else and then make an arbitrage profit marking it up, dispensing it to the outpatient. So that means they roll up pharmacies and they acquire pharmacies. We have to reform that program. And a third one is something called Certificate of Need. That's a state policy.
Yep.
Over half of states. You know, imagine if some new guy wanted to start a radio show and you, who are successful, and the guys who are already successful, got to go to the government and say, no, he's not allowed to stand up and compete against us. I mean, what would happen, right? That would not be
an
efficient way to have a competitive
market. I've always said I don't mind competition. I mean, would I like to be the number one talk show host in America? Sure. But do I want to do it by simply having the government eliminate my competition? No, I'm not a communist.
Exactly, exactly. And in many states, hospitals, if a new guy wants to set up a hospital, I'm being a bit flip here, not everybody wants to set up a hospital, but any kind of competition, the hospitals can say no.
Unbelievable. John Graham is a visiting fellow who contributes a lot of expertise to research at Paragon. John, thanks very much. Hey, everybody's talking about those weight loss injections because, you know, the results are dramatic. They work by lowering your blood sugar and reducing your appetite. But what if you want to lose weight, but you don't want to have the painful weekly injections, especially when you hear about some of the intense side effects? That's why doctors created a weight loss supplement I've tried called Lean. And the results are remarkable. The studied ingredients in Lean have been shown to lower your blood sugar. They burn up fat by converting it to energy. They curb your appetite and your cravings. That means you're not as hungry. Lean is not for the casual dieter who only has a few pounds to lose. The doctors at Brick House Nutrition created Lean for frustrated dieters with 10 or more pounds to lose. I want to get you started with 20% off and free rush shipping. You can add Lean to your healthy diet and exercise plan the way I've done. Visit TakeLean.com and enter Lars for your discount. That's L-A-R-S. That's promo code Lars at TakeLean.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
Brought to you by Central Coast Tractor Work. Trenching, demolition, grading, mowing, and more. No job is too small, and they work weekends. Clear tonight and overnight. Lows in the mid-40s. Sunshine on your Wednesday with high of 80. Sunny Thursday, low 80s. Weather was brought to you by Central Coast Tractor Work. 805-440-6361.
The 10th annual Atascadero Tamale Festival is this Friday and Saturday at the Sunken Gardens. Fiesta Friday kicks off the weekend from 5 to 9 p.m. with live music, tamale vendors open for business, and adult beverages for sale from the Central Coast Zoo Association. Saturday is the main event from 11 to 7 with over 100 vendors, live music and dancers, the famous dancing horses, bounce houses, face painting, chihuahua and pet costume contest, and of course, tamales. More info at visitatascadero.com.
Is this a sign you need a sign? The Blue Printer and Graphics in downtown Paso Robles can help your business be seen. In addition to flyers, business cards, invitations, wine club sign-ups,